Why don't we open it up for some questions? And in the meantime, is there anything that you want to cover as the questions are coming in, Andy, you know, in terms of benefits of Built to Rent or anything else that the audience would or should know about the most amazing and lucrative portions of Built to Rent and why people, why it's such a sexy trend in this industry and why it's here to stay?
Yeah, I would love to get some feedback as to kind of maybe some of the topics that people actually that resonate with folks. Like, I know it's interesting to people to hear about offsite construction. I know that it's interesting for people, you know, to hear about kind of how can somebody with a network of people work themselves into a larger organization and really grow together. Because as everybody's kind of witnessed today in real estate, it would be impossible for Chris to do it all. It would be possible for Derek to do it all. Me and Ruben, we need to have people that are kind of helping each other grow. So the more granular is it, the education on what is Built to Rent and why does it make sense in this market? Is it more about the actual construction build? All of those things are really kind of helpful for us to create educational content that helps us reach people that need to look at this space. Because if you're just doing your dishes right now and you're listening to Ruben's podcast, you need to put it down and think about why you're continuing to bank your head against some of these other asset classes when you've got one that's got a 7-year runway of actual deals getting done in the built to rent space in many of those markets that are in your backyard. So you can get back to the dishes now.
Hilarious. Douglas, I know that you're doing some built to rent, I believe.
Yeah, we're definitely early in the game, guys. You're a lot further ahead of us, and we're sitting back in admiration of the work you guys do and really are just pleased we have you as a resource to lead the way. I'm very fascinated with, and as you just said, Ruben, we're long, big time. We think the data is just like stark. It is so like a blatantly obvious good investment. How are you guys addressing the fear? People are just kind of frozen in place right now. I understand that. But at the same time, taxes don't stop. The need for protecting their wealth doesn't stop. And I'm wondering what you guys are in terms of capital raising. How are you addressing the fear factor?
Yeah, I think Chris is really good at this, but I would just ask them, what is your alternative? Are you putting your money under the mattress? Are you kind of waiting for the markets to come back? Are you kind of hoping that we don't have Wall Street crash? Like, what is the alternative for you? And let's just like everybody kind of heard of Occam's razor, what is likely to happen? Or what is the reason, is likely the reason. Just look at it from like 50,000 feet. Does it make sense that we need housing? Yes. Does it make sense that we're undersupplied? Yes. Does it make sense that younger families couldn't care less about the American dream and can buy companies on their phone and would love to just live in new stuff that are growing, millennials, et cetera? That's the largest kind of area of home creation now as millennials. Does it make sense that people are living longer and love to have their backyards and barbecues, et cetera, and more space? Does it make sense they don't want to be on top or next to each other? All those factors, yes. And so then ask them, what is the alternative?
You know, I'm talking to my friend Vinny Chopra, you know, quite a bit. I believe he's in Phoenix right now. I might go see him for lunch later today. And when I try and challenge him with an objection about something like lending, he's like, oh, yes. I love that question. Thank you for asking. Right. And then he tackles it with confidence. Whatever the question or the objection is that the investor says, like, for example, if someone says, well, how are you dealing with the crazy lending interest rates? Oh, you know what? I love that question. And here's why, because here's what's happening, right? You got lending rates that are going up, which means that people are hesitant to buy houses because they're not able to have the same purchase power. And they are having less houses to buy. People don't want to sell their houses because they have a great interest rate. And if they buy a different house, now they have to have a higher, more expensive rate. So it's causing a lock on the seller side. It's causing a lock on the buyer side. And how does that affect the build to rent? Well, that means that people that want to live in a house, they need a place to go. And if they're not buying now, well, where are they going to go? They're going to go to our build to rent projects. So when you address these kinds of things and show that there's a lot of demand for the product that we're building, from renters and then from institutions on the sales side, once the subdivision is done, you start to explain with confidence what you love about it. And that's one of the greatest things that you can do for capital raising. But we're also exploring all kinds of strategies, right? Working with registered investment advisors, working with family offices, bringing in 1031 money, people that want to park their money into, for example, an opportunity zone, actually have that chance with one of our projects. So depending on what people are trying to do, we're trying to fit their needs with our product, which is sales in general, right? You always take somebody's needs and you fix their problems with what you are trying to provide. So I would say approach capital raising from some of that perspective. And I believe Andy wants to add his two cents.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing, because I think if we were to kind of put an exclamation point on something that Chris said and then something that Derek said, and it's obviously super simple and it's going to be, you know, it's reductive probably. Chris said, I will go to the driveway and I will drop off whatever those documents are, right? How many people on this call know of a deal that fell apart because somebody just said, oh, he's not going to do it, and it's done with? Derek said, oh yeah, maybe I should have just known that other contractor who's done 10 units already knows exactly what to do, right? So people kind of give up with the education on that first or second encounter. And then how many times do we hear, oh yeah, this deal fell apart for this reason or that reason? Chris did not get us two approvals by just saying, oh, okay, I guess they're not going for it. That's not directed at you, Douglas. I know you're a doer, but there's many people on this call that are just coming from other careers into real estate, and they don't understand that it does take multiple steps, multiple follow-up, and a lot of education.
No, Andy, I will say I appreciate that as a reforming intellectual. That is well placed. Thank you. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Who else has a question for Andy, Derek, Chris, or myself, or wants to bring up any topic or just have general commentary about this industry?
Hey, Ruben, quick question.
I have a ton of questions. Is this over at 4 o'clock Eastern time?
We can go a little bit longer. So if anybody needs to drop, I mean, feel free, but I think we'll field questions until everything is answered, or at least until people get tired of hearing us.
But Dinesh, I think he beat you, Irish. So
I want to let Dinesh question. Go ahead.
Dinesh, go ahead.
Did I? Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering, we are building an apartment community in North Carolina. So I wanted to ask you, how do you onboard the property managers for these Class A or Class A plus properties? And what is your marketing and lease up process? Can you shed some light on that?
You mean on the actual lease up process and how we're kind of taking the asset management part from after we've already kind of done the horizontal and vertical? Chris hit it, right? Absorption, that's a big deal, right? At some point, if we do offsite construction, we could build two times, but that has nothing to do with whether we can lease them up, right? So I think Dinesh, your question is more about like, how do you handle the operational piece, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How do you market? Yeah. How do you lease up and all that?
Yeah,
absolutely. Because we are starting from zero.
Right. So every project's a little bit different. I mean, I remember when we developed a project in Venice, it was for sale, right? So now you basically created a marketing company, right? Just to get the word out. For rent, we really have to have strong property managers. We've got our asset management team that's handling all the accounting, all the legal. There's constantly meetings, right? So I wouldn't say there's like a secret formula, but I would say that the integration piece is critical, right? If we don't know what Chris is working on, or we don't know what Derek is working on, and they don't know the accounting that we're kind of tracking, it falls apart. And so I think that you do have to have somebody dedicated, and we do, to manage the property management. Right. And that shouldn't be relying on just what they're saying. It should be vetted, right, and confirmed, right? Trust and verify. So I think that those pieces, and if you're open to it, Dinesh, we would be happy to open up, you know, our team, show you all the systems that we use in place to kind of track things. And that might be helpful or might not.
Great. Thank you.
Irish, why don't we hear from you for a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I applaud you guys for what you do. I think it's a great niche in the market. It's just that, like you said originally, you got to educate a lot of people on how this whole thing works out. But coming from the syndication space, which took me about a good 5 or 6 years to learn, it's like, you know, now you're jumping over to BTR. Now I got to spend another five or 6 years to learn that, unless I do it quicker by following you guys, which is great, you know.
We're partnering with us,
but just entitlement, I mean, it sounds like a big endeavor, and a lot of questions come to mind just like right out of the gate. Is like, you know, your water source, the financing, like is it kind of like partial as you go and then you got to pay him off as you build so many units? Individual taxes per like unit, do you have to establish like an HOA? You know, you got utilities, you got amenities, you got, you know, different roads, You have to have like bylaws and rules and regulations, you know, does it have to be ADA compliant, affordable? I mean, it's just so many questions. I would be here for like 5 hours.
Yeah,
no, I love that. That's why Chris is available. Certainly, Irish, if you guys wanted to have a talk, I'd love to be on that call.
Let me butt in real quick. So one thing that's really important, and I want to address the audience that's tuning in here on the show, is you want to stay in your lane, right? So I don't know how thick the insulation is in the Crest project, but Derek does. I don't know the brand of the cement board that he puts on the outside of the houses or what color paint he does, but Derek does. I don't know exactly what was said in the city meeting or with the official that liked or disliked one of the projects and how it was got across the board and approved by the city, but Chris does. There's all these people that know specific things about property management, underwriting, the asset management, the construction management, the how do we work with the KPs, the how do we work with co-GPs, what are the agreements that are in place. I don't need to know all of it because I have a vast team of specialists that stay in their lane so that we can get these things across. So I do want to mention that for the people that want to potentially raise capital for, or partner with us, or be able to explain the build to rent, you don't have to know the insides and out of every single little detail of every aspect of the industry and or the project, because you have so many people that can answer every specific question that are specialized in that particular thing. But if you want to address this particular topic about like the entitlements and all of that things and how overwhelming that can be, that would probably be a question for Derek and Chris. I'm not sure which one of you guys would want to take that.
So there were a lot of facets to that question. So to back up a little bit, you know, the way these are structured, so we've got a lot to look at from the horizontal side of the project. You know, as I mentioned earlier, some projects are individually platted, some are platted as a single property. Those bring up sort of different availabilities of density and spacing and design. You have to go in and, first of all, with a concept plan typically in the beginning, because again, you're not just saying, I'm doing X amount of residential lots to your spec per your development code, and that's sort of cut and dry. When you first go to them with something that doesn't fit any zoning ordinance, you have to then define what it is you're doing. In the case of Foley, we had to do a PUD, a planned unit development, multifamily. But you'll have to go in and sort of lay out what the streets are going to look like for them, how the units are laid out, where your amenities are. And, you know, as you move through that entitlement process, it might be a PUD, like I mentioned earlier, which has many, many city meetings to get through. And then that planned unit development ordinance becomes a zoning ordinance tied to your parcel of land. In the case of the Crest, we got a preliminary plat, which is basically a plat of land that is subdivided into private streets and lots, and then common area, drainage area, and servitudes. So in that case, we're doing the horizontal construction there currently. And when we're done with horizontal, we'll get final plat, which is where, you know, the individual parcels become parcels and can enter commerce. You mentioned, I believe, you know, ADA compliance. You have to do that on sidewalks, getting over curbs and ramps. That's typical to any subdivision. So you still would abide by, you know, those same rules in those instances. Regarding utilities, you know, that's also part of the sort of upfront negotiating process as we're doing due diligence. You know, we'll talk to the water company, the sewer utility provider, the electrical provider. Typically, at least in Louisiana, there's competition between utility providers for electrical. So both or all three will take you out to lunch and try to convince you to go with them. So you have to go in and sort of negotiate sometimes, you know, what will work better for you and the utility provider. And, you know, consider things like, are they an electrical co-op or are they one of the bigger players, and how that ties into electrical reliability for the neighborhood. So there's a lot of different assets. And I think I'm sort of glossing over a few of the points. The end point I'll make here is each project is unique and quite unique from other projects. We like to create communities. And on the Crest, if you look at that project, it's more of a typical subdivision look. And our other projects, we, you know, sort of took a different approach and making them very community oriented. And so we have a lot of green space, shared green spaces, kind of like bungalow courts, which is a popular development style in Southern California, I believe about 100 years ago. I think Venice actually has a lot of that style. You know, but we take a lot of, you know, sort of urban and new urbanist principles and apply them to our developments to make them desirable. And that's the other thing. Some of the hurdles we face are in trying to create these desirable sort of unconventional looking developments. You know, we have, again, that there's that educational component on, you know, part of the city to get them to understand what it is you're doing.
What would be, in what scenario would we need an HOA for?
Right. Okay. Thank you for bringing that back up.
That's a good question.
The way we're doing all of these currently is it's all under single ownership. So an HOA declaration or restrictions or bylaws are not needed. It'll function as an apartment complex would. It just looks like a neighborhood. In the case where you'd need an HOA, that would be if you were to split ownership on individually platted lots. So if you're selling off rental units, you would then have to form an HOA with a board, bylaws, restrictions, et cetera. And in the case where you had a single property, you would condo association it, which is the same thing, but instead of individually platted lots, you're selling the footprints of the houses themselves, like you would in a typical condo situation. Once you split ownership, that's when you have to go to the association route.
Right. And then we have to create CCNRs and all that, the rest of it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Irish, did we answer your questions or do you have something else?
You got most of them. I kind of rattle them off fast. But what really comes to mind, like a lot of these new developments, is water source and sewerage. I mean, do you have to show to them that there is a water source, or are they going to tell you right off, oh, yeah, it's there, don't worry about it?
So yes, we do that. And before we even put an offer on a property, we make sure that enough capacity is available to the property with water. We do analyze drainage. We want the property to be able to drain and not cause flooding issues if it's a particularly flat site. On sewage, that's a big ticket item, kind of any way you slice it. Areas that typically have kind of gravity sewer right up to the site, ready to tap into, are usually very expensive pieces of land. You know, there's other cases where you're near sewer and you have to put in a force main. A force main is a pressurized sewer line where you have to build a pump, which is expensive, and then, you know, pipe the sewer over to the nearest gravity sewer for the municipality to take over. In the case of the Crest, it was not advantageous to force main the distance we needed to for sewer. So we built our own sewer plant. And that had its own challenges, but it works. And in that case, we're not operating the sewer plant. We're turning it over to the utility district, and they're going to own and operate it and do any maintenance or repairs on it as well as the entire sewer system in the neighborhood.
How dirty is that water, Chris?
You could drink it.
Yeah, I'm always amazed.
Yeah. And just kind of back to the potential pitfalls, you know, we submitted our application based on current regulations. The, I believe, week or week before we submitted the permit for that sewer plant, the state changed the regulations for the water body that our outfall eventually got to, where we had to significantly increase the amount of treatment we did. And that's why we joke we can drink the water out of the sewer plant at the Crest. But that's essentially what we had to do, was output potable water.
Brady is curious if we have time for one more question. I think we have time for a question for you, and then hopefully Andy will take us home by answering how to calculate yield on cost and why that's so important for the people that are interested in raising capital for build to rent. So go ahead, Brady.
It might take Andy longer to explain to me how to calculate that. So I'm glad I got in before he did. So thanks, guys. First of all, appreciate the time. Super informative. So one of the things that, you know, I'm curious about is kind of on the risk side and how you mitigate that. So specifically in entitlement, engineering, and the horizontal, could you explain, you know, what are the major risks to investors? And then also how you mitigate it. If, and if you can't, then what is that real risk to them during those front two stages, or early stages, I should say.
So on the utility side, you know, getting into a situation where you don't have capacity would be a project killer. So if you were to tie into, or assume you could tie into a gravity line without contacting the utility provider with the number of units you're planning, you know, they'll do the volume calculation for you and let you know, can we take your project on? And, you know, typically you'll get a will serve letter. That usually comes a little later once you have a design to give to them. But you always preliminarily go in and mitigate that risk by just doing the homework and getting on the phone and getting meetings set up and sitting down with everybody in the city or the county or jurisdiction that you're in and just having those discussions. You know, other pitfalls you'll find where, you know, things can just go off the rails is flood zone and wetlands. So flood zone, those are two things we like to avoid. There's some instances where you might have a portion of the property that has flood zone and you need to either avoid that area or, you know, use it to get fill dirt if it's good dirt. But, you know, wetlands, you know, I've been involved with projects in the past with a large developer where wetland permits have taken up to 2 years for large, you know, large mitigations of, say, woody wetlands, where it's very, very expensive. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that can go wrong on that side. And also with FEMA, have some direct project experience again with that larger developer where something was sold to a builder before an approval from FEMA happened. And that just snowballed again into a developer cost where they had to cover, you know, the residents' flood zone insurance. Those are things, you know, you want to avoid. You know, avoid regulatory pitfalls with large agencies that don't operate quickly.
Do you guys want to talk real quick before we turn it over to Andy? This whole strategy of when we're purchasing the land to put an option to purchase while we're doing the approval for the engineering. Can we talk about that real quick? Anybody want to take that on? Why do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, sure. That's the main premise on how we approach these is we try, like Chris said early on, to get as long of a purchase option as we can, 270 days, 360 days. That way we can get through as many of those risk mitigants, entitlements as possible. You know, we want to do our soil sampling. We want to get our JD for the wetlands. We want to get as many pre-approvals as we can. We want to get our zoning and our basic city council meetings, get all of that approved to where we're basically at the point where we know we could build a project. We just have to get all the engineering and design work done to have a completed package to send over to start doing the actual work. So we no longer have to go before anyone and get a vote on something to where they could shut us down. It's, you still have to work with certain, you know, government offices on them approving specifics of the engineering in the plans, but those are details. They don't really impact the actual use of the property. Things might shift around a little bit. You might have to have a little more road here or a little more green space there, but you know that you have a project that you could build. So we never take it out to investors unless it's in a JV sort of arrangement. We normally take on all of that risk. And once we know we have basically a shovel ready project or an engineering ready project, that's when we come out and start trying to bring on other partners to eliminate all that outside entitlement risk that you really have no control over how long the process takes and who's going to say what, you know, in different areas. So we try to get all of that answered up front, Brady.
Bring us home, Andy.
Which I just want to put a, you know, a bow on that. I mean, that's why if you can mitigate that risk on the front end, there's so much opportunity in this built to rent game. You've got the entitlement behind you. Now you're dealing with what we talked about earlier, which is streets, roads, utilities, all that stuff's been laid out. And so at each stage, there's more and more opportunity. So yeah, you know, Ruben wants to get into yield and cost. I don't know that you can really do that, but basically from a high level, the yield on cost would be, let's use round numbers. So if, let's just say that you've got 2 million is your stabilized revenue. You're stable after all your rents. You built your project, you got all your rents, you got 2 million bucks, okay? Now let's just say that if we're using the multifamily numbers, 50% of that goes to expenses, right? So now you got $1 million in net income, okay? Now, that's important in a vacuum, no. But if you consider that against the amount of all the money that Chris spent in getting the project entitled, all the money that we put in the land, all of the unit costs that Derek spent building the construction project, let's just say round numbers, that totals 14 million bucks, all right? So divide 1 million by 14 million, it's gotta be around 7, right? It's about a 7%, that's the yield on cost, okay? Now, that doesn't mean anything in and of itself, but if you consider it against what is the market cap rate, that makes a lot of sense. So in built to rent, cap rates are really low right now. They're probably 3s, 4s, but let's just do a market cap rate for a multifamily project in Lafayette, Louisiana, something like that. So let's say it's around 5. So now you take that yield on cost, which was 7, subtract from that cap rate, which is 5, that's a 2%, what we call spread. Now, that the reason that most banks and lenders care about spread is because as cap rates come up a little bit, they want to know that there's enough room and margin there, right? Okay, so that's the spread. We got 2% spread. Now, what I care about, what most people care about, is how much value have we created by putting in that $14 million into the project, getting that $1 million stabilized income. So if you take the 7% minus the 5%, you got the 2% spread. Now take that 2% spread and divide it by that cap rate. So that cap rate was 5%. 2 divided by 5% is 40% development lift. What basically development lift means, it's the value that created, that was created by us putting all of that money and cost into building the project, plus whatever revenue minus the expenses we were able to achieve once it's stabilized. So I don't know, you might have to rewind it. Feel free to call me. Feel free to, I think we wrote a couple of papers about it, but that's why I think that's much more important to an investor to think about than IRR and average annual return, because it's not considering the risk involved in getting those returns. The development lift and the yield on cost is.
All right, cool. With that, we're going to wrap it up, guys. Thanks for staying extra for the question and answer. Really appreciate your time. We got a head thumbs up from Peggy. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll be back next week, and we'll talk to you then. Peace and strength, my friends.
Legacy Acquisitions.